Deezer Originals.
Now, it's time for Strong and Stable.
Strong and Stable, 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 Strong and Stable.
Hello and welcome to Strong and Stable, the podcast that brings you satirical chat faster than Katie Hopkins deleting inaccurate tweets from her timeline. I'm Dom Jolly, your host, and a man with a phone so big not even Piers Morgan could hack it. In the news this week, the Care Quality Commission warned that the NHS can't cope with increased demand coming from illnesses caused by lifestyle choices, such as choosing to live in the UK and choosing to get old. Meanwhile, the happiest places to live in Britain were revealed with Inside Boris Johnson's Head coming in at number one. Also this week, the United States men's football team failed to qualify for the World Cup, although that probably still won't stop them turning up late and claiming they won it. Sorry. And the trailer for Star Wars, The Last Jedi, was released. No spoilers, obviously, but what we can say is that having grown old and bitter living on a forgotten island, Luke Skywalker definitely voted for Brexit. That's right, the farce was with him. And proving that the best things do come in threes, unless it's those awful Star Wars prequels, it's our guests. Tim Shipman is the political editor of the Sunday Times. His book, All Out War, was called the best political book of the year, although it unfortunately gave Donald Trump inspiration for his policy towards North Korea. Shadow Foreign Secretary Emily Thornberry has been the MP for Islington South and Finsbury since 2005. Emily was once accused of being part of the North London liberal elite, a claim I can confirm is inaccurate. I've just seen a Dunkin' Organic artisan biscuit in her Waitrose cappuccino. And finally, John O'Farrell. John is a prolific author, scriptwriter and broadcaster whose career in comedy has included books, TV and writing jokes for Tony Blair, although he admits the Iraq War one went a bit too far. Welcome, dear guests. How are we?
Very well, thank you.
Good,
didn't,
good.
Didn't even plug my new book, Dom.
Eh?
Didn't even plug my new book, Dom.
Well, you're doing it
now,
aren't you?
It's going to only get worse. I am, that's why I'm here.
There you go. Job done. It comes better for you. Now, this week, Donald Trump said he invented the word fake, although obviously what he meant to say was he invented the word kofeve, while Katie Hopkins said there is no such thing as truth anymore. Or did she? Hopkins also said it was her personal opinion that the recent incident outside the Natural History Museum was a terrorist attack. Well, it's my personal opinion that I should replace Hugh Hefner at the Playboy Mansion, but it doesn't mean it's true. Guests, how do we cope when we're being told that there are no facts anymore? Tim?
Well, it's a sort of, it's a great novelty. I've been being lied to by politicians for 20 years, and now everyone's getting uptight because people in the media are doing it as well. I mean, it's a bit depressing for a mainstream journalist when you're trying to sort of hold politicians to account to see that there's so much out there that's just plain made up. But when it's the politicians making it up, we have to cover that as well, and that's what's going on with Trump.
Emily?
I think there has been a crossover between fact and opinion, and so I think that we end up with journalists who are expected to have opinions as well, and then those two things I think are getting more and more melded together.
And here I am.
They mustn't get their facts wrong, and I think that there are some important newspapers that would be very distressed if they realised that what they were publishing was simply wrong. But I do think that the line between a fact and opinion is getting more and more blurred, and that is part of the problem, I think. So you get interviewers. So LBC, for example. On LBC, everybody knows that the people on LBC have strong opinions, and when they've got phone-ins and so on, they will express their opinions. And then those people will bring out certain facts, and people will latch onto those because they trust those people to be able to be the people who will give you the facts. I think it's when the BBC does it, I think people are more worried. And so I think there are certain interviewers on the BBC who we know have strong opinions and who allow those opinions, I think, to come forward when they're interviewing particularly politicians. We have to be careful about this. I think we have to be careful about this. I know that obviously, you know, the BBC and LBC are in competition, but I think people do go to the BBC expecting, they don't expect robots. But I think that we have to be careful when people are opinionated and interviewing in a particular way.
I mean, Lily Allen tweeted that she can't trust the BBC anymore. Katie Hopkins says it peddled state propaganda. I mean, are they doing right, both sides? I mean, what's going Should we trust them?
Well, that's what I'm saying. As I think that fundamentally you can, but I think there has been a tendency for more interviewers to have stronger opinions and for those opinions to show when they're interviewing.
I think everyone has an opinion. That's the point. And the people who think they're neutral or think that there is actually no such thing as objective news, because what you choose to report already says something about you. So I respect the BBC's desire to be neutral and objective. There is no such thing. And I think the thing is self-awareness. Owen Jones goes out there with a comment piece, goes, I am biased, I am on the left. But people say, I'm objective. Well, I don't really believe there's any such thing.
But if we just leave it to a situation where you've just got opinionated people on both sides, you just end up with a bear pit, and you have a lot of the programmes like you have in the United States where it's just a bunch of people shouting at each other. Well, the BBC is the establishment. That's its biggest problem. And right now we're in a political situation where everybody wants to chuck rocks at the establishment.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of truth in that. And I think we also have to be careful that it isn't just that the media could end up like it is in many ways in the United States, but politics could end up like that, because people don't know who to believe and where to go for the truth.
But I think that this has happened. I mean, we start off the conversation talking about the difference between truth and lies and facts. What happened in 2016 was that lies were exposed as lies, and the people pointing this out were put on the defensive, and they were called elites, and they were called they were criticised for being experts. We've had enough of experts saying what is true. This has been the seismic shift, I think, in politics, that people are no longer ashamed of being caught lying. They just repeat the lie more aggressively.
Which weirdly brings us to Donald Trump. In saying he invented fake, has Donald Trump finally moved beyond parody now? John, you used to write for Spitting Image, didn't you?
Yeah, people say to me, God, wouldn't he make a great Spitting Image puppet? And I say, well, no, because what could you put in his mouth that would be more ludicrous than what he's saying already? He said this week, when would it be appropriate to close down news outlets, which is a terrifying concept. So when would it be appropriate in between burning down the Reichstag and annexing the Sudetenland, I think.
I mean Kim Jong-un is probably looking at him going, smart move.
I mean, I'd love to see a spitting image of the sort of private life of Donald Trump where he was depicted a bit like John Major, having a really grey, boring time in private and then emerging like this sort of madman to change the world in public.
With Melania as the real power behind the throne. Trump says he invented the word fake and fake news. Guess what word or expression do you wish you'd invented?
Kavuffy.
Kavuffy.
Yes, Kavuffy.
Was that yours, was it?
No, that was his, but I am full of admiration.
What do we feel it means now?
I think it means nonsense in his head.
But do you think now that word has actually come to be a word? I mean, it is.
Yeah,
it sort of indicates.
It represents Trump's mastery of the brief, doesn't it?
Trump nonsense.
Tim? I've always liked pericombobulations, which I believe was invented by the Blackadder writers. I don't think it's in the dictionary, but I use it all the time.
Meaning?
I've no idea. I think it just means sort of, problems that you're having, suffering from pericombobulations.
Emily.
Pusillanimous.
Oh, nice.
I like that word.
Spell it for three.
I have no idea how to spell it, but I love saying it because I love accusing people of it.
I don't know whether their faces go blank. You go, I don't know if that's a compliment or not.
Seth Meyers on his show said about Trump, sorry, what? You never noticed anyone use the word fake before. You never heard anyone describe your hair, tan, university, foundation, net worth, marriages or business.
That's very good.
I mean, Trump's basically taken the word fake and fake news, it seems to me, and it's his get-out clause for everything, isn't it? Essentially, he can, if he gets pushed out of office, he'll say, well, I could have done it, but the fake news were against me. It's the sort of ultimate conspiracy defence, isn't it?
Well, he just can just lie his way out of any situation. So he says he actually did win the election, if you don't count all the illegal votes, which is no evidence for that whatsoever. 3 million votes that Hillary beat him by. So this is just a massive lie that he just believes in his own head, I think. I mean, I think he's that sociopathic. But it's like saying, are you a liar? No. It's an impossible sort of philosophical conundrum.
At least he sort of owns the word. It's so Trump, isn't it? You know, the sad thing is all the Tory MPs in my WhatsApp groups who now use it whenever they see something they don't like, or fake news, they cry, and it's all rather pathetic.
Is it as bad here as America?
Not yet, no, but the degree to which they're trying to sort of adopt the same kind of tropes as Trump is slightly depressing, I think.
Well, it's depressing. They're seeing him as an aspirational figure, probably. I mean, that's the...
Well, there's a lot of Tory MPs who look at Melania and think, you know, that's not such a bad thing in life. I could do a bit better. But
Emily?
I'm just trying to process what Tim has just said.
These are the same people who called Theresa May mummy before the general election. So.
I don't understand Tories. I really, really don't understand Tories. I try, but I just don't understand.
Have you got no Tory friends then, Emily?
I I sometimes find that I'm getting on with someone. Like I get on, there are certain Tory MPs who I get on with and I'll be talking to them and then suddenly they'll say something completely bizarre. And I go, oh yeah, you're a Tory. I forgot, I keep forgetting.
There's a difference between, we're going off the subject now, but there's a difference between getting on with someone professionally and having to deal with them politely and make something work as to going down the pub with them.
Is it the social equivalent?
I could never go down the pub with a Tory.
You wouldn't?
No.
Really?
No, why would you want to spend a night with somebody who has such a completely, what I think, wrong view of the world?
But you can't distance or go to the pub and talk about normal things?
Well, if we talk about...
if everything's normal, I suppose, but...
Everything comes back to politics, really, in the end.
Is it the equivalent...
Power and wealth distribution and women's rights and...
Yeah, you're fun at the pub.
Yeah, no, well, no, but I mean, you know, if your world view is, in my view, distorted, I don't see how you could be a mate. I do be polite and work with... I've worked with Tories and sat on boards with Dame Angela Rumbold and all sorts, but... To go down the pub with them and come over for Christmas?
Is it the social equivalent of being at a party and getting on with someone and suddenly they mention Jesus?
It's a bit, no, because I can get on with Christians because we're coming at the same ends from different point of view.
Right.
But the Tories are after a different end to me.
So
no friends, Tories, me. Sorry.
So you've never been to a pub socially with a Tory knowingly?
No, that's not the same as, I wouldn't ever develop a friendship with a Tory.
Have you ever kissed one, Dom?
No, never kissed a Tory.
You've never kissed a Tory? I've never kissed a Tory.
But how do you vet them?
No, but I do tend to know who they are.
Right.
So
stripy
I know.
Shirts. Stripy shirts, red jeans.
No.
But what about undercover Tories? Tory moles who might be out to kiss you. Yeah. You've never kissed a Tory mole?
I've really never kissed a Tory, I know.
Really?
Mm.
John?
No.
Tim?
Well, I'm very ecumenical in my kissing, I have to say.
Strong and stable.
So this week, Theresa May refused to say if she would now vote for Brexit. She doesn't answer hypothetical questions or possess a hypothetical backbone. But with the increasing possibility of a no-deal scenario, the government has been accused this week of having a kamikaze approach to Brexit, which isn't just a little unfair, but also inaccurate, as kamikaze pilots generally manage to hit their targets. Philip Hammond, meanwhile, has suggested that a no-deal Brexit could mean planes can't fly into or out of the UK. So a bit like Monarch, then. And Ryanair. And BAE. Oh, and Bombardier. So, guests, do you think we'll have a no-deal Brexit?
I think this is hilarious, because they're going, right, all Europeans, you've got to leave. And the planes are sitting on the tarmac. How exactly? Because the planes aren't taken off because of what you've done. It's like, fly out immediately, but as soon as we sorted out the flight arrangements. Brexit is such a disaster, and Theresa May is making such a bodge job of it. I think she should just get in a couple of Polish guys to do a proper job and fix it. You know, like I do with my DIY when it doesn't work. Get a couple of Polish guys. They'll do a really brilliant job really cheaply.
So we do a job swap with the Polish government?
Yeah. No, just a couple of,
get them sort out the plumbing.
Exactly.
Emily, Gordon Ramsay said this week that Brexit will be good for lazy Brits. Is he right?
No, Brexit.
Sure?
A lot depends on what happens. You know, I do think that there is a grave chance that we're going to end up with no deal. And I think that they're preparing for it in their heads. I think that there's a large proportion of the Tory party that are completely comfortable with no deal. People say there's no difference between Labour and the Conservatives. There's absolutely no way that we want no deal. We don't want to be in a situation in 18 months when, you know, any company that wants to import or export anything is going to need to either face tariffs or go through point of origin. We're going to have to employ tens of thousands of new customs officers. There'll be queues at the docks for, you know, stuff coming in and out of the country. I mean, let alone what would happen in Northern Ireland. It is reckless. It is foolish. It's absolutely extraordinary that there are Tories who really think that it's okay for our country to go sailing off into the mid-Atlantic and somehow or other we're going to be okay. We are not going to be okay. We have to be responsible. People have to look after the economy. That's what governments are supposed to do. They're supposed to look after the safety and security of citizens and the economy. And they're not doing it. And they're just fighting amongst themselves. And Brexit seems to me to be all about, you know, whatever is going on in the Tory party and has been going on in the Tory party for the last couple of years. And they're playing it out with our country. And frankly, if it wasn't so serious, it would be funny.
But not everyone agrees. I mean, Damon Evans on Twitter says both main parties are offering the same Brexit carcass, just with different gravy.
Well, that's not true. We would...
So there you go, Damon.
Well, it's not true. The truth is that we have been trying to make sure that the government gets through the Article 50 negotiations as responsibly as possible, and then that we have an interim period where essentially we have the status quo, so the Tories can do no more harm to our country, so that we can then be in a position whereby hopefully there'll be an election, we'll be able to get another government, and the grown-ups can start negotiating, because quite frankly, this lot are obviously incapable of doing it.
So, John, should there be a second referendum?
I think we should call it the first referendum on the terms of the deal.
So every referendum be the first referendum.
Yes, right? Yeah. But I mean, yes, absolutely. I mean, if you're getting divorced, you have a decree nisi and a decree absolute. If you buy a house, it's subject to survey. And yet we're heading towards this massive political decision. And I think it's irresponsible of the government not to go, are you sure, British people? Here's the deal. Here's what it actually means. Yes or no.
If they come back to Parliament with no deal, then we will not be voting for that. We will not be voting for that. That is completely contrary to the country's interests. There will be a vote in Parliament on the final deal. And, you know, we will be able to exert some influence at that point.
But the Remainers need to be careful what they wish for, because if you have a vote in Parliament or a second referendum, the people voting against it will be the hardest of hard Brexiteers who want us to crash out and go to WTO rules. It won't be a choice between what we had before and what Theresa May is offering. It's going to be a choice between what she's offering and an even worse crash out.
Well, I would say that the referendum should be on, do you want this deal or do you want to change your mind and remain in Europe? I think, you know, being in Europe is still the best option for this country going forward. It just seems mad not to say so publicly and push that
but
agenda.
But the polls suggest that not moved at all. And
I know,
that,
I know.
You know, and until, you know, ask Tony Blair, he'd tell you, until you've got 60% against, there's nothing going to change, unfortunately.
Comedian Matt Green tweeted, Brexit increasingly feels like a man in his 50s getting divorced because he can't wait to get on Tinder and meet loads of 20-year-olds.
Yeah,
yes.
I'm afraid there aren't a load of 20-year-olds that's waiting out there for Britain outside of Europe.
That, you know, no 20-year-olds outside Europe.
There are not. The trade equivalent does not exist. To stretch this metaphor slightly, to breaking point.
Giles Fraser tweeted, Remain has become a middle-class tantrum of people who are used to getting their own way. Tim, what do you think of that?
I think there's something in that. I know that the parts of my personality feel a little bit the same about that sometimes. Yeah, everyone just needs to get a grip. Actually, people agree on a hell of a lot more around this than the political discourse would suggest. You know, most people, including the Labour Party, agree that, you know, we're leaving the single market, we're leaving the customs union, and that the transition will take place and it will look pretty much exactly like what we've got at the moment. There's not actually a lot of disagreement about all of that. We just need to get on with it.
You say there's not a lot of disagreement, but, you know, the baseline is, Tim, is that we have a Tory party that has a position that we can work out whether we disagree with or not. Yeah, but because they're all over the place, you know, it's very difficult. And it's very, you know, and I'm constantly being asked by Europeans, what does the government want? And I'd say, I'm really sorry, but I have absolutely no idea because they have no idea.
Well, that's true. But in July, the Labour Party had about six positions in 4 weeks, if you top them all up.
That's not right.
Well, I think the point is that there are people at the top of the Conservative Party, maybe Labour Party, but they're not in control, so it doesn't really apply so much. But there are people in the Conservative Party who are playing this for their own personal positioning inside the Conservative Party leadership. They're thinking, May is thinking, I need to survive, so I can't alienate this wing or that wing. Boris is thinking, I want to be leader, so I'm playing it this way. And these are massive national stakes here that they're playing with.
That's true, but actually the massive fight between the two sort of demented groups on both sides has actually left Theresa May sort of stuck like a prisoner squarely in the middle, which is probably the best place for her and for the country at the moment.
John, your pub mate, Lord Buckethead, tweeted, wake up, journalists. The correct follow-up question to Mrs. May saying she doesn't answer hypothetical questions is, but what if you did?
Well, as someone who's interviewed Theresa May three times in the last year, it's not just hypothetical questions that she doesn't answer.
Any question. Has she ever answered a question just straight?
Very, very rarely. I remember 20 minutes into my interview with her during the general election campaign, she'd used strong and stable about eight times, and I was beginning literally bang my face against the wall.
She's plugging our podcast. We're very happy with that.
Good branding there.
I did actually, when I was standing against her, she kept saying, every time she was asked about the cuts from the local council, she always went, the council have had to make some very tough choices. And then the third time I was on a panel with her, I said, Theresa May will just say that the council have had to make some very tough choices. And then it came to her and I saw her face freeze over and her brain going, I've got to come up with an original idea. And for a nanosecond, she was trying to think of some creative sentence construction. Then she just went, the council have had to make some very tough choices. And everyone in the audience sort of looked at each other.
Choices that are tough, surely, spin it round.
Just the same thing that I just said she was going to say.
Emily, how do you find our Prime Minister personally? Have you ever had a drink with her? Well, we know you haven't. You've never gone to the pub with her. Have you had tea with her?
We've talked.
You've talked?
Yeah, we've
socially
talked.
Socially or with a chaperone?
We've talked, and we're both interested in encouraging women into politics. We have that in common. We're both in favour of there being a statue for Emily Wilding Davidson in Parliament. She spoke on a platform at a meeting that I organised.
So you've got loads to talk about in
so,
the pub.
So, you know, but yeah, so we do have some things.
2.5 minutes must have just flown.
Strong and stable.
Now, with his usual calm, laid-back take on the week's uneventful politics, it's our special correspondent, Jonathan Pye.
But the Prime Minister seemed to struggle when asked how she'd vote if the referendum were held today. Let's take a listen. What do you mean, I don't answer hypothetical questions? Bollocks! During the campaign, when asked if you'd push the nuclear button, you said abso-fucking-lutely. At least I'm hoping that was a hypothetical. It's as if she didn't see this question coming. Would you vote for Brexit today? It's a pretty obvious question, with surely only one possible answer if you're the person in charge of Brexit. Lie, for fuck's sake! But answer the fucking question. The answer is simple, Theresa. I have changed my mind. I believe that Brexit is a massive opportunity for Yanni. You fucking lie! It's the only possible answer from the person who said Brexit means Brexit, that Brexit will make us strong, confident and united. Then you have to say you'd vote Leave, even if you wouldn't. But instead, her Brexit strategy this week is to go back on her word and start threatening EU nationals. Exactly the opposite of what she said in Florence. She's making it up as she goes along. She's improvising Brexit like it's a fucking jazz solo. And suddenly, it's people that are the bargaining chips. She's not bargaining with money, she's bargaining with people. From someone who has really pushed for laws against modern slavery, one of the few genuine achievements that she's made, it's odd that she's now so willing to use the threat of booting people out as blackmail. Not a great way to open a trade negotiation, is it? Give us reduced custom tariffs, or the toddler gets it. It's a morally repugnant stance to take. Nobody in the Brexit campaign ever suggested EU citizens' rights were on the table. Not even UKIP. This is sub Farage. She's fucking lost it. Not even UKIP. Well, she later went on to clarify her words by saying that...
Jonathan Pye there, whose new book about how he sees the world is called Jonathan Pye Off the Record. Although I have to say, I think he missed a trick not calling it the Pible. This week, the UK was urged to act against racial inequality by a Prime Minister who picked a cabinet containing only two non-white people. Yes, the racial disparity audit showed the true extent of inequality in Britain. Although it could have been worse, the research could have been sponsored by Dove. Also this week, a list was doing the rounds which showed the number of Guardian journalists who went to Oxbridge, which again was a truly shocking figure to absolutely nobody who's been paying attention to the world of journalism over the past 100 years. So, panel, do you feel privileged? Where do we start? Emily, who's Oxbridge here? Hands up, which is good for a podcast. Tim Shipman goes up. No one else. Well done.
No, anyway, I'm the elitist again.
Yeah, so you're the elitist.
I'm more
elitist men of the people,
North
men and women of the people.
It's a multi-million
I think it's a spectrum, isn't it? I think a privilege is a spectrum. And I, as a middle-class white man, am quite a long way towards the extremely privileged end of it. And that's why I sort of make the most of the fact that I didn't go to some posh private school, because it's the only thing I can cling on to that I can feel slightly oppressed when people like David Cameron talk down to people like me. But most of the time, I'm incredibly privileged. And I think the thing is to be aware of your privilege. And so for me to start jumping into the debate on Harvey Weinstein, I think should be done with extreme caution.
But you're going to, aren't you?
I'm not, no. I was holding back. And there's so many men on Twitter going, why don't women do this? I just want to say, shut up and listen, men.
Yeah.
Or shut up and listen, white people.
Yeah.
And that's what I think, just self-awareness, I think, is the key here.
But is it unfair to criticise people for going to Oxbridge? Tim, you're probably the one to ask on that.
Well, I mean, I take the view that I was the first person in my family to go to university, and I got there under my own steam, so I up to a degree. So I think.
But you were showing off a bit by going straight to Oxbridge. If you were the first one, couldn't you have done a lesser uni and your children go to
Oxbridge? So I don't think sort of doing Cambridge necessarily is a sign of privilege. I think going to a grammar school, having parents who had books in the house, who made me write and think and do things from a young age, that was immense privilege. And I think John's right. You've got to recognise where you've come from and try and help people who are coming up behind you to, you know, who don't have some of those advantages. And, you know, I'm a growling old so-and-so, but I do try and help young journalists who are trying to get on. And if they get in touch with me, I try and give them a helping hand.
Dom, I think we'd love to hear from one of the ladies now.
Are you following this, Emily?
So I'm quite often caricatured as being privileged, and in many ways I am. I'm from North London, and yeah, I bought my house 25 years ago, and a North London house in Islington obviously has gone up.
What's it worth then?
I don't know. I think two.
I think
half,
you do.
2.5 million. Maybe.
2.5 mil. Nice.
So it's gone up about 10 times since we bought it 25 years ago.
And what about the house in Jamaica?
I don't have any house.
Do you? Oh, I've been misinformed here.
But I have had to kick my way up, to be quite honest.
You've had to kick your way up?
Well, my mum was a single parent and I was brought up on a council estate and I failed my 11 plus. But my dad was very successful, just that we didn't see a lot of him. And then when I was 15, 16, I went to live with my dad. And then when I was 17, he went to New York for the weekend and didn't come back. So it has been hard.
Would you say?
But I'm not saying I'm not privileged now, because I am. And my kids are very privileged because I have done my best to do well. And I'm proud of myself.
Who would your dad have voted for?
My dad would have voted Labour.
Would he?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No.
Just checking.
No. My dad would have voted Labour. You can't catch me.
I can see that.
And my mum.
I can feel the shirt.
I don't think we blame people for going to Oxbridge or criticise them for having gone to Oxbridge. I think we criticise them if they're not aware of their privilege or they try to claim they're actually disadvantaged in some way by that, which is a conversation I had with somebody recently who said, I was at Footlights and it was worse for me in the 80s in the world of alternative comedy because I was just people were prejudiced against me.
There is a lot of that, actually. There's reverse Oxbridge stuff.
It's a load of nonsense.
They have to hide it.
Yeah. But it's a question of what Tim is saying. He's aware that he's privileged. I'm aware that I'm privileged. And for someone like Emily, she has to be exceptional to get where she is. Real equality will have happened when mediocre white middle class men, don't make it. When mediocre women are put into positions of authority, then we'll have equality.
I think also it's important when you are in a position of authority to do everything that you can, as Tim was saying, to encourage others. Yeah. I was a barrister before I became a politician, and I was in a chambers called Tewkes Court, which was Mike Mansfield's chambers, and we were famous for having half women and about a third of us were ethnic minorities. And we even had some working class people too.
Really?
Yeah. And but what we would do was we would, when we were looking at CVs, we would look at what people had done with the opportunities that they'd had and how well they had done, not just did they get a first from Oxbridge, I'm afraid. So it was so you'd look at it in the round, and for that reason,
I was far too busy getting drunk to get a first.
I'm just saying that I think was an important way of looking at things, and we were a chambers with outstandingly good people, and we were looked to, and people kind of went, "How did you do that?" And it goes, "Well, because we just chose the best people."
This all goes back to that whole thing about the establishment being the thing that everyone's pushing against. People spend years and years trying to become members of the establishment, and they get there and discover it's really naff.
In the interest of balance, though, the Tories are also interested in this. Jacob Rees-Mogg agrees action on racial disparity is essential. He's ordered his Filipino houseboy to look into this immediately. So I don't think we can be too unfair on them.
Nothing to say to that.
It's left us all stunned with this.
You have to remember that Jacob Rees-Mogg once used the word flocky knocky porson helipilification in the House of Commons. So.
who are the elite in Britain today? Has it changed?
It has. I think it changed when New Labour came to power, that suddenly someone like me, who wrote a book about that, got a column on The Guardian, was invited to Downing Street. Suddenly I was initiated into the Liberal elite. I've still got my membership card. It was fantastic. Polly Toynbee gave it to me.
Tim?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, Peter Oborne had this theory a few years ago about the sort of political media establishment being this one hideous amorphous class, and I think he was probably onto something. But I think to some degree it's changed a little bit. David Cameron took things a little bit back towards, the old school tie. And there's a slight feeling now that, the them and us is a little bit different from what it was when Blair was around.
It's very subtle. There's a good thread by Sarah Perry, the writer, this week on Twitter about how when she walked into a room full of publishers, she just didn't know anyone else there. Everyone else was saying, remember we were at Trinity together, or your sister was at St Paul's with me. She said not knowing anyone or not knowing your way round is hard for somebody to understand who's not on the inside.
I agree with you, and I agree with everything, but I think there's an additional element which I think is really interesting, which is the new establishment in the Labour Party is very different to what people have been used to before. And I think there's a lot of kind of people getting their heads around that. Who are the movers and shakers in the Labour Party these days? If we are going to be the next government, what are the influences? Because it is very different to the Labour Party a few years ago.
Sure. Yeah.
And I, what,
Go on, Tim.
I agree with John about, you know, that whole thing of walking into a room and not knowing anyone. When I first started going to party conferences sort of 17 years ago, I didn't know anyone, and it was absolute hell going into a bar full of people enjoying themselves and not knowing anyone. And, you know, you get to the stage where you do know everyone, and after a while that gets boring as well.
Yes. What was your technique then?
Just buy lots of drinks.
For yourself or for everyone?
Well, you start with yourself, and then you get some Dutch courage to march up to other people and start trying to talk to them. And you find that, really, for a free drink, quite a lot of people will do almost anything.
But, Tim, did you go to the Momentum rally?
I didn't.
I went to that, and I tell you, there wasn't any rallying. There wasn't any talk. They just seemed to be dancing. So I went in and was sort of, you know, doing 1980s soul girl dancing.
Discos I went to, which were hell as well when you're trying to talk to girls.
This is all back to our student discos.
It's where they're left, to the left.
Yeah. But it's just very odd because this is a new powerhouse coming into the Labour Party. And
they're all 25.
And they're all 25. And they all come, you know, bouncing around. And I mean, I remember I was walking down the front and there were these two young women who came bouncing up to me going, "Emily, Emily, Emily, Emily." They were like a couple of tiggers. And I said, okay. And they were going, "Can we have our photo taken with you? Because we're two Emilys." So we had to kind of get them to stop jumping up and down in order to have a photograph taken.
Is that
and
drinks or drugs?
This is just momentum. This is just the enthusiasm, extraordinary kind of people coming into party conference. And so at our conference, I honestly think about half of them had never been to party conference before. I think it's changed.
Thing that's happening is that social media actually cuts through a lot of this. I have a load of people that I'm friends with on Twitter or whatever, and I sometimes meet them in real life, but not that often. Yeah. And some of them are 15, 20 years younger. But if you interact in an engaging way, you actually can
And you use emojis.
Well, that's part of the trick, yeah. But you can then find that you actually become friends with these people and you understand their worldview and you interact. Well, they all hit 40 and they end up Tories anyway, John. So.
47.
Well, I think we can all agree that UK must take action on class and racial disparity, demand a group of powerful white people. I think that's great.
Strong and stable.
Now it seems that the fault lines in politics these days fall along generational lines as much as ideological ones. The new insult by young people on the left is apparently centrist dad, which is ridiculous. The centrist dad, one of my favourite bands. Well, this week, Tory MP James Cleverly showed he was really down with the kids by writing a piece which used the cultural analogy of Pulp's 1995 album Different Class. I look forward to reading Jacob Rees-Mogg's think piece on Blur. Well, he does live in a house, a very big house in the country. Do you feel there's a real divide between the old and the young when it comes to politics now? I mean, you were talking about momentum and stuff. What is the divide?
Well, I don't think that the divide is necessarily that much. I just think that at party conference, it really came home to me that we had such a large number of youngsters who
enjoying
were so
themselves.
And so enthusiastic and idealistic and just an injection of energy into the Labour Party, which is brilliant. It is brilliant.
Can you talk us through the new sort of the slang that's coming in, for instance? I mean, melt, Emily?
I mean, honestly, fortunately, I've got young people in my office, I've got young people at home. And so when I'm sent messages on social media, I say, is there a young person here? Can someone explain to me, am I being insulted when they say I'm well bang tidy? You know,
you're being triple complimented there. It's actually the same thing.
It's full on Harvey Weinstein.
It really is, isn't it? So you're not a fan of Celebrity Juice, clearly, or you'd have known that one.
I don't know.
But do you really not follow all that stuff? I mean, some of them are a bit weird. Melt, for instance, is a new word, isn't it?
Cheese toasty, isn't it?
Me, if you're a total melt, it's a great word. Yeah. But it actually means, do you know what it means?
I have no idea.
Really?
Really? People have to explain these things.
Okay, well, melt is apparently a non-Corbynista, sort of Corbynist mistruster, a melter.
So it's got nothing to do with snowflakes?
No, not at all. No, it's completely different.
Okay.
That's different. What about a slug?
No idea.
It's an even worse one, isn't it?
Is it?
Than
yeah.
A melt, I think.
Yeah. What's a slug?
Well, that's someone who's much more hostile, I think, to the Corbyn project.
Yeah, so he's far right of a melt?
I would think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, or just more aggressive about it.
Right, are any of you centrist dads? What does this mean?
I would try to argue that I'm not a centrist dad. Then I realise my book opens with my kids going to me, "Oh my God, Dad, you are so moderate. You are so..." Actually, somebody said to me in the...
You've got a book out, John.
I have got a book out called Things Can Only Get Worse. It's in all good bookshops and two crap ones as well.
Okay.
So my book opens with me and my kids laughing at my non-radicalness. But I would hope I'm not a centrist dad just because I don't feel I'm at the centre of the Labour Party. I feel I'm slightly on the left. And the point about that is dads have been telling younger people how this politics works and they can't do that anymore because we don't know anymore. We didn't foresee Brexit, we didn't foresee Trump, and we didn't foresee the last election result. So we have to listen rather than, you know, patronise and talk down to people.
Speaking of which, the average age of Tory members is 71, apparently. How can the Tories win the youth vote? Have they lost the youth vote for the foreseeable future?
I think it has to be. It has to come from the ground up. It has to come from the ground up. It has to be. I don't think that they can graft anything genuine onto the Tory party. It has to be. Are young people interested in Tory politics? If so, they will get involved. They're not interested. Guess what? But they are interested in our politics, and that's why we have this injection of enthusiasm.
But is it actually possible to have a right-wing youth movement?
When I was a student, there was a Tory Federation of Conservative Students. They're all Hang Mandela t-shirts and, you know...
Hang Mandela?
Hang Mandela t-shirts they used to wear. They're all now columnists for The Spectator and The Telegraph.
Really?
Yeah.
Toby Young, is it?
They keep getting disbanded, don't they?
They kept embarrassing them, and they had to sort of, yeah, Tebbets would close them down on a regular basis.
It's very difficult for the Tories to do this sort of thing. The thing that brought home to me most recently how the Tories can't do the youth vote was when Michael Gove was being reshuffled and given his new job. And he thought it was all a wind-up, and that one of his mates had phoned up and told him to come to Downing Street. And he got this extraordinary message saying, drive here and then park here and then you'll be met, but there's a rally going on, so we'll bring you through an underpass. And he said to me, this whole thing made me think I was going to come out into this underpass and see Dom Jolly recreating Trigger Happy TV. And I thought, well, that's quite funny. And I thought, literally nobody under the age of 30 will have a clue what he's talking about.
Luckily, new Trigger Happy is out next week. Thank you very much for doing it.
So that
should sort that out. We haven't plugged everyone so far. Speaking of slang, after centrist dad, can we think what's coming next? Moderate mum, neoliberal nan? Where are we going? Are there any good words you've heard?
I suppose this is like the way the politicians were defining people as Worcester woman and, you know, Basildon man. Those were sort of target voter labels, weren't they?
David Amos.
In the past. Yes. But it's all a bit simplistic and a bit, you know, it's a bit, to say someone's a centrist dad, it sort of makes their opinions invalid. And everyone's opinions are valid. We want to hear from the centrist dads and the, you know, the left wing.
But aren't these terms the sort of terms that are applied by polling organisations that, frankly, are sort of a little bit out of touch anyway now?
I don't know.
Yes.
All right.
That was good chat.
Sorry.
Well, the great thing about being a journalist who's got it all wrong is that the pollsters have got it even more wrong pretty much every time for the last few years.
Do you think pollsters are going to be wrong for... I mean, that's it, the end of polling? Or was that a brief blip? Are they going to work out how to get back it? Or what's...
They always fight the last war. So they had a terrible time in 2015 because they couldn't find, all the Tory voters. So they went and looked extra hard for them this time and found too many of them. And that's always going to be their problem. Because ultimately you get your raw figures and then you have to sit there and apply your own kind of model to it. And that boils down to personal judgment.
I think it was also because there was an awful lot of people who were just discounted because they didn't think that they would vote. And it isn't just young people. It was also a lot of people who were marginalised and disaffected. And, you know, and frankly, we didn't knock on their doors. We had them down as non-voters, so we didn't bother to knock on their doors. And then, lo and behold, they turned up and they voted Labour.
If you read my new book, Dom, about the election...
Have you got a new book, too?
Coming shortly. But you will discover that, you know, both political parties cocked this up. Neither of them saw it coming. Lots of Corbynistas claim they did, but Labour High Command didn't.
What's your new book about, Tim?
It's about the chaos of the last year.
Oh, all right. So not much to write about.
A year of political mayhem.
Yeah. Emily, do you have a book coming out? TV show?
I'm a bit busy.
Can I just say, Dom, that Tim's Brexit book was very, very good.
It was. My mum liked it. Yeah. And she's a tough crowd, I tell you.
It felt like a political thriller.
Yeah, it did. Political discourse has always turned up new terms to describe people of particular political persuasions. In the 19th century, you had the Whigs. In the 1980s, you had the Wets. And, of course, up till fairly recently, you had those fuckers from UKIP. So... I think we'll end there. Finally, it's time for our game. Who said this week? So just pick who said it. Brexit is not a game. Little hint?
Theresa May?
Brexit is not a game.
Juncker?
No.
Macron?
My French accent was a bit better than that. Yeah. Michel Barnier.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, fantastic Barnier impression.
This one's slightly easier. I think I am actually humble. I think I'm much more humble than you would understand.
That was Trump.
I'm the humblest person in the world. I am. There is nobody more humble than me. I think Trump absolutely nailed it with that one. I mean, he cannot go higher than that, but of course he will. Emily, this is one for you with your youth knowledge. Trump,
oh, no.
When it comes to giving a shit, you're stingy as I am, except when it comes to having the balls to go against me, you hide 'em. You notice by my hand youth movements that it's probably something to do with popular culture. Who said that?
I don't even understand what it means.
Well, maybe Alan, I should have wrapped it better. Would you like to do it?
Wasn't Alan Bennett, was it?
No, it wasn't Alan Bennett. Trump, when it comes to giving a shit, you're stingy as I am, except when it comes to having the balls to go against me, you hide them. That's why I'm not a rapper, but it's Eminem.
I was going to say Eminem. Okay.
Are you familiar with Eminem?
Yes, I know who Eminem
the
is.
The Sweets? What? In retaliation, now that was Eminem in his new rap, The Storm. Okay. Which obviously you've taken down. In retaliation, Trump has now claimed he has the best rap names, including a Trump called Quest, Snoop Don, and the notorious Bigly. Totally lost on you, Emily, isn't it? Ring your kids. Who said this? You can't be a trot and own an allotment.
Oh, I did hear that.
Yeah, I heard those too.
Well, who was he talking about?
He talked about Corbyn.
Yeah.
Was it Jacob Rees-Mogg?
No, we can't
bring him up every time,
No.
David Owen.
That's David Owen.
Yeah. Corbyn is apparently concerned about the location of his allotment, as people are always telling him, he's lost the plot, I thank you.
Very good.
God, Emily, you're a tough crowd here.
Good stony face from Emily.
Right, what about this one? What I did last time round was I looked at everything and came to a judgment, and I'd do exactly the same this time round.
Theresa May
on Brexit, on whether she'd vote, which way she'd vote in a new referendum.
For a bonus point, interviewed by?
Ian Dale,
nice. Well done, and LBC. Yeah. Good that. Of course, Tory MPs who supported the leadership bid are muttering they wouldn't do the same this time round. And the final one is, I've seen this raw strength only once before. It didn't scare me enough then. It does now.
Ooh, wow.
Big political figure there, so it's pretty easy. No?
Deafening silence.
Mark Hamill as Luke Skywalker in the trailer for Star Wars The Last Jedi. The new Star Wars trailer landed this week as Carrie Fisher joined Harvey Weinstein in the list of people making their last appearance in film in 2017. And just like Harvey Weinstein's filmmaking career, we've unfortunately come to an end. But unlike Harvey Weinstein's wife, we'll be back soon. Huge thanks to our guests, Tim Shipman, Emily Thornberry and John O'Farrell, our reporter Jonathan Pye, and our writers Andrea Mann, Robin Flavel and Dan Bowman. This has been Strong and Stable, a That Lot production for Deezer. And we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
That was Strong and Stable. We'll catch you next time. Please subscribe.
Deezer. Originals.